580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
In Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with author William Berkson, that's spelled B-E-R-K-S-O-N. He's the author of a guide called Timeless Wisdom for Modern Life that's based on an ancient Jewish text. Is that right?
Right,
no,
right.
It comes from the second century of the Common Era.
Right. It basically
or
from
even
the,
earlier.
Yeah, it comes from the second century BCE to the second century CE. So there's a 400-year window. It's really sort of right in the middle of Jewish history, which is 4,000 years. It's right in the middle.
And you call this the wisdom of the sages. Now, who were these sages?
The sages were the post-biblical sages. In other words, by that 200
BCE.
The Hebrew Bible, right. Yes. I'm talking about the Hebrew Bible. So the Hebrew Bible had finished, was codified by then. And these were post-biblical sages who created the Mishnah and the Talmud. And they really created Judaism as we know it. But they also laid the foundations for what became Christianity and Islam. So I like to say that the sages of Pirkei Avot, book that I'm commenting on, is the what I call the old time religion, which is the foundation for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of them.
And you're interested in this, and you created this book a year or so ago. For what purpose? I should have introduced said a little bit more about you in the introduction. You're here in Champaign-Urbana, and you've just come from Chicago, and you've been making presentations, and you're going to be at Sinai Temple and at Hillel Foundation here at the University of Illinois. But you're the director of the Jewish Institute for Youth and Family.
Right.
And you're going to be talking about various issues at Sinai and Hillel we'll talk
right.
about later. But you created this book for what specific audience?
It's basically part of my sort of mission or fascination with how people live their lives now under the pressures of modern life and how they respond to modern life.
And particularly young people,
but also older. Originally I was trained in history and philosophy of science. They're interested in how we make decisions about science, how we create new theories and how we judge between them. But I was always interested in how people make decisions in daily life. And that led me first to read a lot of psychology. But then I saw really the rudder, sort of what guide our lives, are our values. And that, since I am Jewish, I was interested in Jewish tradition. So I looked back into it, and I found out this is sort of the core text on Jewish ethics. And when I read it, it was as if it was a new, fresh thing that nobody knew about. It was like, wow, there's just these great ideas. Nobody has heard of them. I mean, of course, that's not really true, but at the same time, it is true because to me, it wasn't fully appreciated. I was just entranced by it, and it drew me in. I learned enough Hebrew to be able to read Pirkei Avot just because I thought it was such an interesting and exciting text. My motivation is really, you know, just as an individual struggling with the challenge of modern life and helping others do the same.
Let's say a little bit more about your background, because it is particularly interesting for local folks here in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois area. Of course, this program is heard in Indiana as well and all the way from Indianapolis to Chicago, but for local folks who might have a chance to actually see you and talk with you while you're here this week, let's tell them about your background. You were saying to me earlier that you have had a grandfather who taught at the University of Illinois
right.
starting in what year?
1910.
Wow.
Yeah.
And his field was?
German. He was a professor of German language, particularly scientific German. He taught in those days. Germany was a scientific leader, and if you were a research scientist, you had to learn German, like the Germans now have to learn English.
Sure, but anyway. Sure. And he was on the faculty until
42 when he died.
Wow. Quite a tenure. My grandfather also was on the faculty here.
Oh, that's interesting.
My mother's father, he taught business law. Dillavu is his name, Essel Dillavu. And then you grew up in Champaign-Urbana. You told me you went to what school?
Champaign High.
Champaign High School.
Right. And Southside, and then Edison, and then Champaign High.
And then went on to the University of Illinois.
Yes.
But then your PhD is from the London School of Economics.
Right.
And you studied there in philosophy.
Right. Yeah, history and philosophy of science specifically.
With Karl Popper.
Right.
Okay. Quite a well-known name.
Right.
And I was impressed in reading this book how widely you've obviously read, because I was trying to take notes on some of the things, some of the people you were referring to and quoting, everybody from Einstein and Buber to people who wrote books like Why I Don't Believe in God, Bertrand Russell.
Right.
And the philosopher Michael Polanyi, and the list just goes on and on. You've studied the history and logic of science sort of professionally, but your interests have been very broad.
Right. I guess the way my head works is that I'm a sort of historian of ideas, I guess, basically. I don't feel I understand something unless I know why it was created.
Uh-huh.
And when I know the social milieu out of which it came and what problems that generation was wrestling with, then I feel like I understand what the ideas were really about. So in the book, I try to put the ideas in historical context, you know, both what became before and then what came afterwards and what was made of them. And I guess, you know, this wide eclectic thing, you know, sometimes I feel like all of this various knowledge I've accumulated now in a long life, somehow all of the bits that stuck to me seem to be relevant to all of these issues in Pirkei Avot, which itself, of course, is very wide-ranging because it deals with all kinds of aspects of life.
For our non-Jewish listeners, let me spell Pirkei Avot. It's P-I-R-K-E, that's one word, and then Avot, A-V-O-T.
Right.
But you subtitled your book Timeless Wisdom for Modern Life, and again, the author is William Berkson, B-E-R-K-S-O-N. So if you put William Berkson in your search engine, you'll come up with this book, even if you can't remember how to spell Pirkei Avot. Let's talk a little bit about how this book is organized. First of all, I'm not sure what to call them, the wise sayings.
Right. Actually, in Hebrew, each one is called a Mishnah, but you can call it a saying also.
All right. I'm a foreigner here with this language. But people, Jewish people encounter them in worship. They're part of...
Right. They're not so much part of the prayer service, but they're in every traditional prayer book.
Traditional, you mean Orthodox?
Yeah, I mean Orthodox and conservative. And actually, the last Reform one had most of Pirkei Avot, but the recent Reform one doesn't, unfortunately. It's traditionally, because it's actually very short. It's, the sayings altogether maybe takes up 12 pages.
You have them all in the back.
Right, in the
together.
Back I put them so you can read that continuously, the whole thing, which is sort of an experience in itself just to read it. To read it straight through. It's about, I don't know, 50 or 60 sages and about 100 sayings. So it's very compact, but as I say, it's very rich because it encapsulates a whole point of view, which also was seminal both for Judaism and had its influence on Christianity and Islam.
Well, I've selected a couple examples that I thought would be helpful for our listeners to get a taste, a flavor of how you deal with them. And in each one of these, you talk about its original meaning first century of the Common Era. And then you also have a section on modern life and how you think it fits in with, say, modern psychology.
Right.
But let's take an example. Well, here's one almost at random, but it's very appropriate for a university setting where you are now, of course. Be deliberate in judging, educate many students, make a fence around the Torah, around the law.
Right.
Tell us how you dealt with those three sayings that are traditionally and have been for 2,000 years grouped together.
Right, right. Well, this is an important saying because it was one of the Pharisees who really created what later became rabbinic Judaism. And their idea was, you know, educate many students or raise up many disciples, it's sometimes translated. They wanted to have a group of people who are knowledgeable in Jewish tradition and particularly in Jewish law, because they were in the law courts, like in civil and criminal law as well as religious law. But what to me what's fascinating about this be deliberate in judging, the Hebrew is metunim, it means slow, careful. To me, there's two interesting things. One is it's important to be careful about not judging too quickly. In another place in Pirkei Avot, the Hillel says, do not judge another person until you've come into his place. So you have to mentally put yourself in the other person's place. So the idea about it's very important not to make snap judgments and to try to put yourself in the other places, but you do judge. In other words, these folks, a lot of them actually worked as judges, you know, in law courts. So they weren't saying don't judge. Which goes against the relativism that says, you know, everybody's opinion, everybody's entitled to his own view, and if you make a moral judgment, you're being intolerant. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a mistaken popular idea in America that the foundation of tolerance is relativism. And here, you know, what I advocate is a humble universalism, which is to say they're universal ideas, but we should be very humble about whether we know them or not. So we should discuss with others.
Let me give the phone numbers so that listeners can have a chance to join this conversation. We're always eager on Keeping the Faith to have our listeners ask questions or make comments. You can do that by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If it's a long-distance call, you may use a toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. And your call will be answered by our good technical director, Kyle Crow, and she'll put you in line to be on the air live with our guest today, Bill Berkson, talking about these wisdom of the Jewish sages. Bill, go on a little bit about telling us about judging. And let me just interject. Many Christians who are listening, when they hear the word Pharisees, think only of sort of bad people who were often criticized in Christian writing, early Christian writings. But in Jewish tradition, the Pharisees, as you point out in your book, are contrasted with the Sadducees, who are having their own internal arguments. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, frankly, I think the Pharisees got a bad rap in the New Testament because, you know, if you actually read them, you'll see that they're very high-minded. On the whole, they're very high-minded and inspiring people. Undoubtedly, there were some amongst them, like amongst every religious organization, of people who are hypocrites and very annoying. And in fact, even the Pharisees themselves talk about the plague of the Pharisees, which refers to those who were hypocritically pious. Mm. So such people actually existed, but it's really a misreading of history to think of them only as this kind of person.
I want to continue that discussion in just a minute, but we have our first caller, and I do want to go to line number one and let this person join in. Go right ahead.
My question is related, but slightly off the subject.
That's fine.
I am very fascinated by this, but I'm a pretty much homebound person. Is there any possibility that when you are at Sinai Temple or Hillel, that you would allow your presentations to be taped so that they could be either video or audio, so that they could be in the libraries of these two organizations. And if it is video, how do you feel about it being put on the public TV access station that we have here in Champaign? It really sounds like wonderful stuff and should be disseminated widely.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I would be delighted. I'll ask the venues that I go to whether they would do this, but, of course, I can't answer for them.
Right. Perhaps I will call also and suggest somebody, and that would be a very generous act on your part, and I will hang up and keep on listening.
Thanks.
Thank you for the call and the suggestion, and I might just add that if you have a friend who you know is going to be at either or both places, they could perhaps just take along a portable tape recorder, since our guest today, Bill Berkson, has said that's fine. And incidentally, this program, of course, is recorded and will be available in the archives online. So if you have friends who would like to hear this discussion, you may tell them to go to will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith, and they can hear this at their convenience. It'll appear on that website in just often a couple days, but at least in a week or so. So there are several opportunities, but thank you for the question. Bill, we're talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees and
right.
Judging. Why don't you tell us a little bit more?
Well, I think that the issue of relativism and judging is actually a key one, because, you know, we have a tradition in America, and I'm not sure when it started. As I say, I'm a historian of ideas, so I try to track these things down, but I think it goes back to John Dewey, which is relativistic and says that not judging anybody is the foundation of tolerance. And I think that's a mistake, because what happens is that's a kind of tolerance that only goes so far as indifference. But when you actually interact with somebody else, you're going to need to make judgments.
You talk about the importance of arguing and discussing.
Right. So the problem is, when you have a conflict, if you're a relativist, you're only left with emotional warfare or indifference or actual violence. Whereas if you believe that there's some common values that you can appeal to, even though you're not sure about what the right ones are, then you have a basis for discussion. So for me, it's not relativism but humility, that I have to be willing to say, you might be right and I might be wrong, and let me listen to you, and if you do the same for me, maybe we can find some common ground, that we can find a mutually satisfactory path. So I think the fostering that discussion amongst people that don't agree is really important, whether it's in a family or, you know, between groups in a nation. So I really feel strongly that this kind of humble universalism that I'm advocating, and that I think is sort of embodied in a way in Jewish tradition, even though it's confined to those who are accepting a certain religious tradition. Within that tradition, they do accept and understand diverse points of view. You know, for example, another place in Pirkei Avot, it says, every dispute for the sake of heaven will endure. And they recorded minority opinions as well as majority opinions. The idea being, in another generation, maybe somebody will take up the minority opinion and it may turn out to be good. So there's an appreciation of an ongoing dialogue as something that's very deeply rooted, and really is, as I say, memorialized in Pirkei Avot, in that saying. And then it's seen throughout the Talmud.
It's interesting that that sort of conflict within Jewish thought it's been seen to be important to record it. And
right.
As you say, pass it on for future generations. Is there a sense in which this collection of Jewish wisdom that comes from this 400-year period, 2,000 years ago, is this in any sense seminal? Is it something that...
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It's really seminal, because And this is not generally understood, often not by Jews and certainly not by Christians. And for different historical reasons, somehow the real history of ideas has never gotten across. The reality is that Rabbinic Judaism is a very different religion than the religion of the ancient Israelites. It's different in ethics, in theology, in ritual. And it was really a synthesis of ancient Greek wisdom and Hebraic wisdom, because at the time, Judea was part of the Hellenistic empires. There were
world, yes.
Yeah, it was part of the Hellenistic world. Alexander the Great had conquered Judea in, I think it was 332 BCE. So by this time, you know, starting in 200 BCE, those living in Judea, particularly educated people, often spoke Greek and knew about Greek wisdom, and it was a challenge to them. And the undercurrent in the whole book is, how do we reconcile the wisdom of the Greeks and the wisdom of the Hebrews? That's something that, and that first synthesis came together like in the first century BCE with Hillel, who's sort of the foundational figure in this book, in Pirkei Avot. And it was definitely seminal because as Judaism emerged later, it incorporated these ideas. This was originally sort of the introduction to the Mishnah, which was then the introduction to the Talmud. But then also in Judea in the first century, the ideas that were current in the time of Jesus, the actual form of Judaism in terms of ethics was the ethics in Pirkei Avot, not the ethics of the Torah. You know, often people will read, both Jews and Christians will read the Torah and read those sections in Exodus and Deuteronomy that are just horrific, you know, about all of these punishments, and it seems like a very harsh religion. Well, if you take the sages, they cancel almost all of those harsh punishments. For example, I mean, one illustration is on capital punishment, and you can be there's capital punishment for practically everything in the Torah.
Yeah,
in Leviticus, you know, you get whacked for almost anything. But for this, the sages, they said that if a person murders another person, they have to be warned by people beforehand not to do the murder, and it has to be witnessed by two people. And they surrounded capital punishment with so many prohibitions. They said that a Sanhedrin that has a capital punishment, even once in a generation, is a bloody Sanhedrin. There, the whole shift was in the Hebrew Bible. There's a whole big emphasis on conquering the land and all the wars and all of this, but with the rabbis, you have the emphasis is on peace and loving kindness. So there's a shift in the ethic to peace and loving kindness.
But those themes are also found in the Torah.
Yeah,
but in
they're
different
also
places.
Found in the Torah, yeah. But they're not. As the emphasis has changed critically, because as I say, in the Talmud, the rabbis specifically go through all of those harsh things and with one argument or another cancel them out. And then they put, like in Pirkei Avot, it says the three things the world stands on. One of them is acts of kindness. You know, it says Torah, worship, and acts of kindness, basically study of Torah, worship, and acts of kindness. So acts of kindness become a central, and the word for kindness, chesed, becomes also the word for a pious person.
Loving kindness, mercy,
piety. Right. A person who is pious is also a person who's kind. It's called the chassid, which means both piety and kindness. And it's a characteristic of the rabbis that they reinterpret old words in a new way, like tzedakah, which means righteousness, which is the like justice in personal relationships, fairness, becomes the word for charity. So Hillel said more tzedakah, more peace, but it could be more righteousness, more peace, or more charity, more peace. And he probably meant both. So, I mean, that sort of gives you the flavor of how it shifted from a more defensive kind of posture to an emphasis on love, kindness, and peace. The other big change was the bringing of judgment in an afterlife, which only happened during the 2nd century BCE.
I want to talk a little bit about that because that's one of the things I thought would be of particular interest to listeners of any religious faith or of none, how the whole notion of the afterlife developed in Judaism only after a very long time.
Right,
and,
right. It's
a
relatively...
very specific time, and I want to get to that, but
right.
We're about halfway through our program today here on Keeping the Faith. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. William Berkson, B-E-R-K-S-O-N, author of Pirkei Avot, Timeless Wisdom for Modern Life. This is a guide or a commentary for contemporary folks based on material that comes from 2,000 years ago in Jewish tradition. We'll be getting back to Bill in just a moment, and I might just tell right now when he'll be able to be heard at various times here locally in Champaign-Urbana. We've already had a request that some of those be taped for people who might be homebound and be able to see a video or audio recording of that. But Wednesday at Sinai Temple, you'll be addressing a group of seniors who meet about 1 o'clock, maybe at lunch too. I'm not sure about that, but at least you'll be speaking to them at 1 o'clock Wednesday. That's also open to people who might choose to come. Thursday at 8 p.m. at Hillel on campus, the Jewish Center for Student, the Center for Jewish Student Life, the Cohen Center, the Hillel Foundation on the corner of, John and 5th Street on campus. You'll be speaking at Hillel at 8 p.m. And you are the scholar for a Scholars Weekend at Hillel, and so you'll be speaking there again on Friday.
That's at Sinai Temple.
I'm sorry, at Sinai Temple. I apologize. Sinai Temple, I did have that written down, but I said it wrong. So for the regular Sabbath service, you'll be giving a short a talk during the service. It's open to anyone, of course, but then following the service, probably about 8:45 or so, you'll be giving a longer talk. And then again, Saturday at lunchtime, that's another occasion for the public to hear you talk and ask you questions. You'll be talking after lunch about 1 o'clock on the Sabbath on Saturday. And then Sunday morning at 11, you're still at Sinai Temple, talking at the religious school to the kids and the parents and also people from the community who'd like to come Sunday at 11. So there are several opportunities for people to hear Bill Berkson if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you have questions, you could call either Hillel or Sinai Temple, and they could answer those questions for you. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although Don Nolan fills in for me very ably often when I'm unable to be here or when he has special expertise to interview our guests. For the next several weeks, I plan to be here. Next week, I'll be talking by phone with Professor Jay Wilcoxon from Chicago about various study Bibles. These are mainly Christian Bibles, but there's one example of a Jewish study Bible that just come out fairly recently that he's also going to give a review of. So that'll be on February 12th here in 2012 Keeping the Faith. On February 19, my guest will be a visiting scholar to Hillel Foundation on campus, Jay Mickelson. He'll be talking about the religious case for gay rights. He'll be at Hillel, but he'll be talking with us on February 19. Then on February 26, here on Keeping the Faith, I'll be interviewing by phone Christopher Mitchell, who is the director of the Wade Center in Wheaton, Illinois, that collects materials on 7 different Christian writers. But we're specifically that day, on February 26, talking about the C.S. Lewis collection. And so he'll be talking about that February 26. Coming up in March and April, we have several interesting programs. We'll be learning about the crop walk in March, also hearing about some folks who've been doing some work in Kenya and in Africa. And so we'll also be playing an archive program right before the Roger Ebert Film Festival, of one of the last times that Roger back when he still was able to speak, when he could use his voice, when he was talking about religious themes in film. So we're going to be replaying that program that he made live here in Keeping the Faith back before the very first Ebert Fest, the very first Overlooked Film Festival 12 years ago. So that'll be a treat to hear Roger's voice again. Okay, let's get back to I should mention something about the University YMCA, which has been a supporter of Keeping the Faith for these many years. Friday forums have started up, and so if you'd like information about that, go to the University YMCA website and universityymca.org, and you can learn about the various Friday forum speakers that are coming up this semester. Or you may call the Y at 337-1500. That's in the area code 217. And let me get the phone numbers again for people who'd like to ask our guest today, Bill Berkson, a question about his book on the ancient Jewish sages' wisdom, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or long distance, 800-222-9455. Bill, let me read just a couple sentences from one place in your book that I thought would give people a sense of your style. And I might say your style is just very engaging. I mean, here you are talking about wisdom from 2,000 years ago, but you refer to current rappers and you refer to writings of Ayn Rand, and you make this so relevant and so interesting. But just to give people a little sense of how serious some of the serious topics you deal with, you talk about the blossoming of Jewish mysticism in the Middle Ages, and you say it was partly a reaction against the rigidity of former times. And you talk about mystics, and you talk about the highest goal was no longer a life of love and work lived ethically and imbued with holiness. The primary goal was now, during this time of focusing on mysticism, a time of direct experience of God. And the Jews at this time, the Jewish thinkers, the Jewish intellectuals were sort of leading people to turn away from daily life, from love, work, the pursuit of justice. And you say, in your view, this was a decay of Judaism resulting from the fact they were in exile, they were experiencing horrible times, the persecution. But you say this paragraph next: now that Jews' political rights have been restored, the results of the process of emancipation beginning around 1800, the Jewish state of Israel has been restored, you say, I think that the Judaism of the sages of this earlier time represents a healthier and more dynamic model for Jews to look to for the future. Now, you're kind of putting yourself out there.
Right.
Why do you think that?
Well, you know, it's remarkable that in a way the, you know, Max Weber, the great sociologist, called Judaism a pariah religion and tried to make the case that the religious views of Judaism were sort of a reaction to a pariah status. But I think that's wrong, because during the formative period of Judaism, which is the period of Pirkei Avot, they were actually, to a degree, masters of their own house. They were, it's true they were a colony, but they still had a great deal of internal governance. But then they were, they were completely out of Judea, a new mindset came in. And one of the things that, in a way, was positive was there was a unity to Jewish thinking. So if you ask the question, what is Judaism, during the Talmudic period, you can give a clear answer, because they discussed issues and they came to decisions, and you really know what it's about. And that Talmudic synthesis was sort of held until about 1800, when the Jews were emancipated. And now, you know, as you know, Judaism again has become diverse. I mean, you mentioned before the Pharisees, the Sadducees. There were the Essenes, you know, the monastic group. Actually, in ancient Israel, Judaism, there were many Judaisms, so to speak. It was very diverse. And we have that today. You know, you have the ultra-Orthodox, you have Reform, you have secular Jews. It's very broad. So in a way, the condition of Jews now is more similar to the condition long before. So just as far as our situation, I think that's one reason. But another thing is that a lot of people are attracted to, you know, you were reading the passage on mysticism. A lot of people are attracted to this idea of, you know, relief from the stress of modern life. And they look at Buddhism as an example. And
you mentioned Jubus.
Yes, Jubus, exactly. There's a very serious movement of people, sure, who want to combine Judaism and Buddhism, or they're just culturally Jewish and they're serious Buddhists, or they want to combine the two.
Sure.
And this is a, you know, intellectually serious thing. And I do find many beautiful ideas in Buddhism, which I appreciate, and I think could be, you know, brought into Judaism. Particularly their teachings on compassion and the psychology of compassion, I think, are very profound. But what I said about the decline, mysticism being a decline of Judaism, is that I do think engagement with life, with family, with seeking social justice, with engagement with life is a higher aspiration than escaping. I mean, the poet Robert Frost said, "Earth's the right place for love," you know. And writing about the Stoics, who had a similar view or aspiration as the Buddhists, namely their ideal is to not suffer. You know, that's the highest ideal, is to avoid suffering. And actually the sages were reacting and interacting with them. And there was a scholar of, a Christian scholar of Stoicism, who made the similar point. He said that he thinks Stoicism was a failure of nerve, because he said, when you commit to this life, you commit to love, anxiety is the cost of love. If you want to totally avoid anxiety, then you go off and be a monk on the mountaintop and meditate. But if you're engaged with life, there's an inevitable cost. And both traditional Judaism and Christianity are philosophies of engagement.
When you were writing about the changes within Judaism, right before the break, we had just gotten to the whole issue of within Judaism, there came finally a development beyond sort of just the ethics of how to live in this life. But things were so bad that you talk about, maybe it was the persecution, maybe it was the horrible loss of life. But people began to think, could there possibly be life beyond this life?
Right, right. In the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, I mean, Torah narrowly defined the five books of Moses, there's not an explicit discussion of an afterlife.
No.
There's a thing, Sheol, which is sort of the grave, but there's no idea particularly, and the key thing is reward and punishment. There is reward and punishment in the Torah, but it's in this life.
In this life. Sure.
In other words, if you do right, you'll be rewarded, you know, with many children and crops, and you know, the rains will come and so on. And likewise, the punishments are in this life. But what happened, and I think, I mean, partly it was no doubt due to cultural influences of both coming from Persia, where you had Zoroastrianism, which had the idea of resurrection and an afterlife, and from the Greeks, who had the idea of the separate soul that was eternal. But there was also the pressure of the Battle of the Maccabees against the Assyrians. And at that time, many of the most pious Jews were being killed, you know, in battle by the Assyrians. And so, of course, the Jews at that time said, where is the covenant?
Sure.
You know, God has promised to protect us, Jewish people, if we live according to the covenant. And the answer was, the judgment is not in this life, but in an afterlife. And at that point, Judaism accepted the notion of judgment in an afterlife.
And how did that show up in this period of Pirkei Avot?
Well, it shows up in specific sayings in Pirkei Avot, where it asserts, for example, Judah the Prince, Yehuda HaNasi, says that if you want to keep far from sin, remember that above you are an eye that sees, an ear that hears, and all your deeds written in a book. I mean, that's the classic idea of, you know, God is noting whether you're naughty or nice, and it's all written. And when you get to heaven, you're going to have to make a accounting for it all. So there are many places in Pirkei Avot where you have a reference to judgment in an afterlife. But there are also notes of skepticism, which we also see, you know, in the book of Job, where they're wrestling with reward and punishment, and their answer is in the end that we don't know, that God is beyond us. And there's sayings like that in Pirkei Avot. It says, not within our grasp are the comfort of the wicked and the sufferings of the innocent.
Now, there are many Jews today, particularly, I suppose, in America and Western Europe, who have no notion that there's any life beyond this life. Again,
right.
just like in earlier Jewish times.
Yes, I think it is more similar, actually.
And yet you feel that some of these threads, these themes in the ancient sages from 2,000 years ago can be a helpful contrast to that, something people should consider? What?
Right. Well, the thing is, what's interesting is the seeds of a view which doesn't accept judgment in an afterlife, which frankly I don't think most Jews accept now, outside Orthodox Jews or maybe even the extreme Orthodox, who do accept it, because it is a traditional part of Judaism, a central part of traditional Judaism. But I think most modern Jews do not accept it,
right.
Or certainly liberal Jews. But there's the seeds of another view, and you can see already the sages were thinking about it. There's a saying, a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which says, do not be like servants who serve the master for the sake of reward. Serve the master not for the sake of reward. And the interpretation of this is that you should not look to reward and punishment to motivate you. You should serve out of love. You should serve. The reward of doing good is its own reward. It says, in fact, the reward of a mitzvah is a mitzvah, and the punishment of a sin mitzvah is a good deed,
yeah, right?
A good deed. So the reward of a good deed is a good deed, and punishment for a sin is a sin. So you have this strand, and actually, that saying, I mean, it is legitimate to say that it's like a subversive or countercultural element in the sages. Because in the Talmud, it notes that some people read that saying as denying the afterlife and, in fact, established the Sadducees. In other words, they think that the part of ancient Judaism that was associated with the temple and denied the reality of the afterlife and only accepted the Torah and not what the sages were teaching, you know, were inspired by that. So what I'm saying is the daily wisdom part of Pirkei Avot is something that I think all Jews, in fact, most people, I think, can learn from positively. I think the stuff on reward and punishment is probably something people cannot accept, but I think they have an alternative view which is still viable today. So, you know, I come at this not as an apologist, so to speak. I'm not a clergyman, so I'm not, you know, like there to defend the faith or preach the faith. I really wanted to put the sages and modern thinkers and ancient thinkers all on the same page and say, who's right? Who can teach us?
Let's talk about it. We're talking with Bill Berkson. Dr. Berkson is the director of the Jewish Institute for Youth and Family. He's in the Midwest for a Scholars Weekend being sponsored by the Sinai Temple and the Hillel Foundation at the Cohen Center for Jewish Student Life at the University of Illinois campus. We're talking with him today live here in the WILL studio. We're encouraging listeners to make a comment, ask a question, 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana. If it's farther away, including if you're listening on the Internet, you may call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. And as I said before, if you've missed part of this program or would like to hear earlier programs, you may go to the archives here at WILL. That's at will.illinois.edu/ Keeping the Faith and just leave the G off of keeping, because when the program was named 12 years ago, someone was very informal. It wasn't me. It was someone else. Let's talk a little bit about the whole notion in your book, this guide you've created for these ancient wise sayings. You point out that these sages 2,000 years ago were the first ones to push for universal education. Now, it was just for boys, but still, they were trying to educate all the boys.
Right.
How did that come about, and what did it result in besides what we have today?
Well, yeah, I think it's a very interesting story. Partly it's an influence of the ancient Greeks, you know, who had schools. The sophists had schools to educate young people. And what happened, as I said, the Rabbinic Judaism was a synthesis of Greek wisdom and Hebraic wisdom. And the way it was synthesized is, first of all, they codified the Torah as a sacred text, in other words, made a sacred canon. And then they said that studying it would elevate your character. So study became very important. But there was also an idea, which is already in the Torah, that Jews are supposed to be a nation of priests and a holy people. So whereas in other cultures, it was usually only the priests and scribes who were literate, because every Jew was supposed to view himself as a priest, particularly after the fall of the temple, it became an aspiration that all Jews should study, and that study was sacred in itself. And, you know, we can see this even till today with the disproportionate participation of Jews in academic life and professions. This really comes from this belief that learning is something sacred.
And it should be for everyone.
And it should be for everyone, absolutely.
Now, when did women get included in that?
Actually, I think women only got in very late. Like in the Middle Ages, we knew they could read Yiddish, not Hebrew, because they didn't study the ancient languages as much. So I think it was only in the late Middle Ages when women were scholars. There is one scholar in the Talmud, Beruria, who is as knowledgeable as the men and also respected, but that was an exception. I mean, the Jewish tradition is very patriarchal, and one of the ways I get into trouble in my book is that I'm quite frank that it was very patriarchal. Oh. And I don't try to, beat around the bush and apologize for it. It's only really fully changed actually in the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
So it's only fully changed recently.
But not unlike other religious traditions.
Absolutely. Basically, all religious traditions were patriarchal until the 20th century.
Some would argue that early on there were some matriarchal ones, but it's very debatable.
Oh, right. Well, you may look amongst, certainly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam were all patriarchal to various degrees. So,
In this section where you talk in your book about the system of universal education for boys that was started about 1900 years ago, I guess, you have this interesting paragraph. Whether or not there is divine authority for ethical principles, as Judaism holds, the fact is that some ethical principles promote social harmony and prosperity, and other values, such as callousness and domination, now celebrated in gangster rap music, leads to strife, violence, and poverty. Now, you're obviously writing for a wide audience, including young people, and you're making a reference to gangster rap. Now, how do you know about it?
Well, I see it like my kids tell me about it and to a degree defend it, because it was when my kids were growing up. I mean, they're already, they're adults or in the early 30s. But rap was the new thing, and the moral status of gangster rap, MTV was on in the house, so it was preaching an ethic of callousness, including toward women, by the way, which was to me really alarming. I mean, I realize now that there are many different varieties of rap, and my son assures me that in the beginning it was actually about love and peace and was an alternative to violence, but it some branches of it turned it into a very ugly ethic.
Sure. Where else do you see ethics currently that are in opposition to the wisdom of the sages?
Where don't I?
Let's talk a little bit about Wall Street.
Yes.
Because you do in your book.
Right, right. Well, I mean, with Wall Street, you know, I think Wall Street is really an illustration of where an ethic of cheating and getting away with it has grown and grown. You know, it's remarkable. They have done surveys going back to the 50s on how many students cheat at school. And they've increased and increased. And I think these are robust numbers. You know, this is not just old fogies saying, oh, things are getting worse. I mean, I think this is documented. And this attitude that it doesn't matter if I cheat and the main thing is to get ahead. I mean, you know, in America, we have a very competitive society. And that pressures people to try to get ahead by any means. And I think that attitude, which has gotten more and more in the schools, then got on Wall Street as well. And I mean, and it's very clear that these people ignored their fiduciary responsibilities and really did not take ethics seriously. And the result is, you know, exactly as I said, when you have this failure where trust, you know, ethics creates trust amongst people. Because if somebody is ethical, you know you can rely on them to do the right thing. And when they're only out after themselves, it divides people from one another and trust is lost. And trust is essential for a financial system to work. And we saw when trust broke down in 2008, the whole financial system collapsed. So, you know, that's so to speak, you know, I think you bring up the most appropriate example because it shows how unethical behavior can lead to a collapse of a society. And it almost, you know, sent us into a depression, and it sent us into a mini-depression. So I think that's a wonderful example about this stuff is not just talking. It's really consequential.
And on all things considered, just an hour before we began, they had an economist from one of the biggest bond sellers in America, in the world, I guess, who is saying we may not be out of it successfully yet if problems in Europe. So it's a major, you know, it may be a worldwide issue that grew out largely from a lack of ethics. As you point out, one of the sayings in your book that you're quoting from 2,000 years ago is, "Who is rich? One who rejoices in his portion."
Right.
How different that is from, dare I say, the results of the Protestant Christian ethic.
Well, unintended. I mean, to be fair, Calvin would not have preached that his heirs become very acquisitive and have an unbridled greed, so to speak. But unfortunately, it sometimes led that direction. But I should say also about the issue of ethics and Wall Street, it's not only individual ethics, but it's also the need to create law that encourages people to be ethical and doesn't tempt them to be unethical. And the predecessor to this collapse was the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the refusal to regulate derivatives. And both of those, by the way, were advocated by Alan Greenspan, who was a disciple of Ayn Rand. And Ayn Rand preached that kind of unbridled, you know, what she called virtue of selfishness. So we definitely, we have a philosophy which celebrates, I mean, it's not just that they're against the ethic of the sages, but they actually celebrate that kind of pirate, you know, capitalism as something good. And it was licensed even under the Clinton administration. So it's not just a partisan thing, but it's a whole ethos that got a grip of our society that we have to extract ourselves from if we're going to be as successful again as we were before.
In your section of Pirkei Avot, Timeless Wisdom for Modern Life. You say, Bill Berkson, that you were talking about these three things upon which the world rests: worship, acts of kindness, study of Torah, study of the law, the ethics, and then these ethical wise sayings that were then pulled together 2,000 years ago. You talk about Ayn Rand,
right,
and you talk about her book, The Virtue of Selfishness, and people, of course, have read The Fountainhead and so on. But you say her views were also popularized by such admirers as Robert Ringer, the author of Winning Through Intimidation.
Right.
And you talk about on issues of basic values suitable for a competitive society, it is these ancient sages who you feel have a deep understanding, and Ayn Rand, whose views are shallow and destructive.
Right. Ayn Rand had this idea of, she looked upon relationships as kind of like a commercial transaction of buying cabbages. You know, I give you something and you give me, I give you the dollars, you give me the cabbage. And that's a relationship. And if I'm not getting something from you now, you know, what have you done for me lately? Then I break the relationship. Now, the problem is that most relationships, particularly family relationships, we want to be long-term. I mean, to marriage, we want to be long-term. Raising children has to be long-term. And when you're
long-term, children are very damaged.
Or the children are very damaged. So,
of course, they may be anyway.
Well, that can also happen. But the statistics are, you know, that, I mean, most children also of divorce do well in life, but there's roughly a doubling of problems, both psychological and academic, for children of divorce. So it's definitely a serious problem. But the point, and I mean, we see similar things in financial things. The key thing is that trust and commitment are key parts of good relationships that Ayn Rand never recognizes. And that's because we have to take a risk. In other words, if I'm going to marry somebody, I'm taking a huge risk. I'm tying my fate to theirs. And then what I need to know is actually that they have good character, that they're ethical.
Which brings us back to the ancient sages.
Absolutely. That's why I'm saying that they're so profound.
And why you say that they're so profound. And right. I appreciated your introduction of me to them. I had not read them before. And I'm afraid we are out of time, but I want to thank Bill Berkson, our guest today, author of Pirkei Avot, P-I-R-K-E-A-V-O-T. Berkson is spelled B-E-R-K-S-O-N. Dr. Berkson will be speaking at Hillel here at the University of Illinois this Thursday at 8 o'clock. The other places, he'll be speaking several other times, but always at Sinai Temple Wednesday at 1 o'clock and Friday night at the Sabbath service, and following it, the Sabbath service is at 7:30 at Sinai, and he'll talk probably about 8:45 Saturday morning at Saturday noon about 1 o'clock and Sunday about 11 o'clock. These talks are open to the public. You can have a chance to meet him, ask him questions, or argue with him. He loves argument.
That's right.
And so did the ancient sages. So, again, thanks, Bill, for being on the program. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I remind listeners that next week we'll be talking by phone with Professor Jay Wilcoxon about study Bibles, but mainly Christian, but all including one Jewish study Bible. On February 19, 2012, Jay Mickelson will talk about the religious case for gay rights. He'll be a speaker at the Cohen Center for Jewish Student Life, the Hillel Foundation at the University of Illinois campus. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, Rethinking Animal Intelligence, Maybe How Memory Works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Should Black History Month be ended? Find out why. More than a month, our next community cinema examines what the treatment of history tells us about race and power in contemporary America. The free public screening is at the Maine Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, February 7th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
This is Illinois Public Media.